You're listening to episode 143 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of FlickChart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
I'm Hannah Kiefer.
And I'm Doug Van Hollen.
And we're here to sort through the best movies of all time, two at a time, head to head. And as we pick the better film between each pair of movies, our chart better represents all of our collective taste in film. If you're not already on Flick Chart, head over to flickchart.com. Sign up absolutely for free and get started by ranking all your favorite movies on an account of your very own. On this episode, we're going to be adding the most recent M. Night Shyamalan film, Split, to our chart. So let's go ahead and get into some fights in the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything is possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
All right, first up, we've got The Mask against 300. So The Mask is Jim Carrey's big Looney Tunes live action-ish a movie where he has a green face and does crazy stuff to try to win over Cameron Diaz, which I think that was her first role. And Jim Carrey is definitely running on all cylinders. He's Plastic Man to his nth degree on this movie. 300 is the testosterone-fueled sword and sandal epic. Kind of after Gladiator, this is the one movie that comes to mind that kind of creates that same feeling of just barbaric fighting and really cool visuals, lots of interesting cinematography stuff going on, kind of an extension on the Sin City-ish vibe, not quite as stark as that, but certainly very over-the-top stylized. And really, I remember coming out of the theater feeling very manly after seeing it for some reason. Like I felt like I wanted to punch or kick or slash somebody with a sword.
Just wait right until somebody gets in my way.
Yeah. What did you guys think of these two movies?
Yeah, I like both these movies. I mean, they're both kind of two really interesting takes on what comic book movies could be. We have a very different sense of what that is in kind of the modern era and in the 20-teens. The Mask was, I guess in both these cases, these were very audacious ideas for films. I keep calling it The 300, but it's just 300. 300 is was a beloved comic book graphic novel, which I was not familiar with, but that's always problematic whenever you're trying to translate something that's already beloved to the screen. And then in the case of The Mask, this nothing like this had really been attempted before, back in the mid 90s of, it sort of is a spiritual successor to Who Framed Roger Rabbit a little bit, where
I could see that.
Yeah, you have the world of cartoons bleeding over into, quote unquote, the real world. I mean, again, right. I believe this is also based on a comic book or a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, the one thing that these two movies have in common for me is that they don't stand up well to rewatching. I've rewatched both of these a lot, and they do start to show their seams a little bit the more that you watch them. The Mask has some kind of pretty amateurish cinematography problems and sound cues that just don't really make sense. And the 300, the stylization is really overblown. And it, you know, once it's had its initial impact on you, it doesn't really hold water. I think that I'm going to pick The Mask here because of my love for Jim Carrey and how much this was really, you know, allowed him to kind of be all that he could be. But it's a very, very close choice for me.
So I have not seen 300, but I hate The Mask so much. 300 has never been high on my list. Like, I'm supposed to see it eventually. Gerard Butler's in that one, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, because I have a vendetta against him. But that's a whole different story. I suspect I'd like it more than The Mask. My biggest problem with The Mask, aside from not... I mean, I don't find Jim Carrey that over the top. When he's that over the top, I don't find him very funny. But I remember I had to go and look up my original review of it and my blog to remember exactly what it was that bugged me. And it was that he was so obviously cartoony, and then the real world around him was neither cartoony enough to match him nor realistic enough that they, like, it was like they had these gritty crime boss evil bad guys who don't bat an eye when they're shooting at somebody and he turns into a matador for no reason. And right. I was like, I could not make the world did not work in my head. And I needed them to either be reacting to the fact that he's a cartoon, or I needed for them to be part of the cartoon as well. And for the fact that for neither one, like, I felt like I was watching two different movies and that they were trying to, like, I don't even know.
So the Pee Wee Herman problem then.
It was the Pee Wee Herman problem. That. Exactly. But maybe weirder because, like, they... Pee Wee Herman, at least they reacted to him, but they at least reacted to him acknowledging what he was doing. Like, they didn't think it was weird, but, like, in The Mask, like, it felt, I don't know, it was like it was a whole group of improvisers, and then you have, like, this one guy who comes in and, like, makes everything his own story, and they kind of just keep going with whatever they're coming up with, and they're kind of ignoring all the random stuff he's doing on the side. And I just remember being so frustrated trying to piece together and trying to find any kind of character, anything in this movie that it made me insane. Like, couldn't deal with it. And, like, my sister came upstairs and was like, are you okay? What are you watching? Because I keep hearing you, like, screaming at the TV.
I think that's a pretty common thing, though, in movies where some characters just don't react how real people would react to insane or unbelievable or, unexplainable phenomenon that's occurring in front of them. They just seem to sort of have a blank slate of reaction, and that doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. It, like it was like they genuinely didn't know what he was doing and that he was, like, acting it all out on his own later. It was so strange. I would assume I would like 300 more. I mean, it's not at all my kind of movie, but I would have to. Unless it was really, really unpleasant, I can't imagine I'd like it.
There is a wall of corpses in one of these films.
Yeah.
Are people reacting appropriately to it?
Yeah. They show concern.
Are people responding to it the way humans might respond, given the fictional world they're in? Then that sounds fine to me.
Yeah. There are some unbelievable characters in 300, too, where people seem to be not thinking that's too crazy within the context of the story, but
it's like
they've built a science fiction world, I think, in 300, perhaps they haven't communicated that correctly, the science fiction nature of The Mask's world or the fantasy nature.
Yeah. Yeah, at least not to the other people in the movie.
Yeah, I think, you know, even today people still quote "This is Sparta," you know, that kick scene. It's for whatever reason, maybe it's just the trailer and the how great the trailer was. Use a Nine Inch Nails song to probably the most perfect use of a song to a trailer ever, I think. It just really makes you want to see the movie. And it has a lot of visual splendor to it that I think the mask is lacking in comparison. You know, I remember really liking all of what I saw on screen in 300. It felt like a living painting in various parts of the movie. And, you know, even if it's incredibly sort of male power fantasy kind of a movie, it still has, just on a visual level, something interesting to show as an art form, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So we've got one for The Mask, one for 300, and Anna has not seen 300. So we'll go to the globals and see what they say. 300 is 710 globally, and The Mask is 1,993 globally. So 300 is going to take it over The Mask. All right. Next up, we've got The Karate Kid against One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So to be specific, this is the original Karate Kid from 1984, not the remake starring Will Smith's son. And I don't remember. Who is the Pat Burrito character? Is it
Jackie Chan?
Jackie Chan. Yes, right. Which isn't, he isn't a karate guy either, right? It's completely off.
He is Chinese, not Japanese.
which, like, why does Hollywood continue to make those mistakes, right? I loved Karate Kid as a kid. When it came out, I was, I was six. So it was, I think I probably saw it maybe a year or two later on VHS. So I would probably been 7 or 8 when I finally saw it. But
that's the perfect age.
Yeah, it was exactly the kind of movie that kind of just blows your mind as a young boy to think it's, you can totally put yourself in his shoes, and you're stuck there in this situation that you don't know how you're gonna make it through, and you have bullies, and you have all these, you know, new people that you have to figure out where you fit in with, and he finds karate as his outlet somehow, and the whole process of how he gets taught and the overcoming the obstacles that he has to go through. It's just such a great sort of fable. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is really great too. It's in a really interesting drama. It's got one of the nastiest nurses ever to be on film. Lots of unusual, strange dynamic stuff between characters, weird dialogue and kind of unusual situations. It doesn't feel, as you're watching, it doesn't feel like you know what's going to happen. It's not predictable whatsoever. And it doesn't really resolve in the way you would expect either. So it's a very unique and interesting film in its own right. I'm not really sure which one of these is better. Which one's better for you guys?
I do like both of these movies a lot. I think Karate Kid is delightful, and it's interesting, and both the actors in it do a great job. But One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is just, it's one of those movies that just hits me every time I watch it. I think Nurse Ratched is one of the best film characters in existence. Mm. I think she's so, the evilness is so subtle, and so, like, she could just be doing her job and it's like, and it's really not until you start seeing the whole pattern that you're like, oh my gosh. I think she's just, and she's played brilliantly, and I think the ending is uplifting in a really unusual way, but right, in a very, very different way from The Karate Kid.
Yes.
And it's just one of those, and I think Jack Nicholson is great at it. Like, I think I would say that's his best role, and he just nails it. And the whole, and all the side characters, all the side characters of Christopher Lloyd, who's in it, and Danny DeVito, who's in it, and all these other characters, and they're so good, and it's, I love it a lot, And I think it's a more powerful film. I think it's a stronger film. I think Karate Kid is great and a lot of fun, but it's not transcendently amazing for me the same way that Cuckoo's Nest is. So I'm voting Cuckoo's Nest, but I do like Karate Kid. So props to it.
Now, Doug,
it's not going to win.
I imagine that you're probably going to bring up the chewing gum in Cuckoo's Nest.
Sure. Yeah. For those of you playing the Doug drinking game at home, I'm going to go ahead and reference my own blog here this is one of the key chewing gum moments in film history is in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So that's always been very important to me. So there isn't a prison riot in this one. There isn't any sci-fi guns, but there is chewing gum. So that's one of my button issues. Juicy fruit. Absolutely. And it's those sorts of touches that bring so much reality to that story. The Karate Kid is not about reality. I mean, you use the word fable, and that's like a brilliant way to characterize it. It's this little fantasy that happens. And whereas One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the challenge is to make the place seem bad, but not nightmarish, to make, you know, the antagonists seem antagonistic, but not caricatures, and to make the crazy people seem crazy, but to make them seem human. Oh, they're humans with mental illness. You know, and you sort of see these sort of nuances start to develop over the course of the film. I think that I'm more lukewarm on both these films than I probably should be. I'm not a huge One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest fan, partly because there's a lot of, I find there's like a lot of moral problems that I kind of have with like all the characters, even especially the Jack Nicholson character, where the kind of premise is that he's trying to get out of prison labor. And so he pleads insanity. And then it's never really clear whether he is, you know, what exactly his relationship is to the people with legitimate mental illnesses. And his true opinion of them. I was always very, kind of confused and preoccupied with that, rather than whatever human story is trying to be told there. With the Karate Kid, I mean, I've talked about it on the show before. Like it's very improbable. You have a situation where a child trains for a summer and becomes the greatest karate fighter ever. He wins a tournament. Where he's been training for like 3 months and mainly training by sanding wood. So, you know,
wax on, wax off.
Yeah. So I find that that's kind of a poisonous message to be sending in a kind of a young adult movie. And so, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that either. I mean, I think of these two, I'm going to choose One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I just think that, you know, the quality of sort of all the different aspects of it is much higher.
I get that, that because of the compression of time in a single film's runtime, you kind of have concessions to make. And that's a big one that Karate Kid does. The idea of how much time it took for him to become able to compete in a master competition.
Right. Mr. Miyagi steals a black belt from a black belt so that Daniel-san can be wearing a black belt. Like, yeah. I mean, for anyone who's ever tried to accomplish things in your life, you know, like, that's so morally offensive that, like, you, black belts are earned, right? Like, that needs to mean something. And for symbols like that to be abused in, you know, children's movies, I don't know. I don't give it a pass for it being 1984 and a kid's movie. Like, I feel like they could have done that differently. I don't know. I think I came to a lot of these conclusions seeing the movie as an adult, and that's a mistake.
Right. Yeah. As a kid, none of that matters. It's all about, right. You know, he was in a rough spot, a father figure helped him out, which he had none, and he was able to with great perseverance overcome hard obstacles and save the day.
Yeah,
and get the girl.
Right. Yeah. And the important thing, I mean, I guess maybe the most important thing about Karate Kid is Ralph Macchio's performance is amazing. It's an incredible performance for a semi-child actor. I'm trying to figure out how old he was when he filmed that role, but I mean, it's really great. Like, he's really naturalistic and he's very, you know, he's physical, and he, I really, I mean, that's what I definitely applaud about that film.
Yep. All right. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest will beat The Karate Kid. All right. Next up, we have Finding Nemo against RoboCop. I like Nemo just fine, but I love RoboCop. So I don't know that there's anything that I can point to in Nemo that's going to be able to transcend all of the things that RoboCop gets right. What do you think, Doug? Is there anything in Nemo that's really, really good that I'm overlooking that would have any candle to RoboCop?
I can imagine arguments one could make. None that I can make. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously the message that Finding Nemo is sending is more complex and more human. You're probably, you know, the thing is you're equally likely to cry at either of these films, depending what kind of person you are. So like they're both emotionally rich, deep films, just for very different audiences. I mean, what I find so fascinating about Finding Nemo is that it's really a story. It's a children's movie for fathers. And I think that's just like, it's another example of like Pixar really, really doing something really amazing and unusual. And there's so many just beautiful, hilarious moments in it.
As a father, I guess I never really thought of it specifically as a sort of fatherhood movie, but I guess it makes sense because it's the dad looking for Nemo in the movie. But I guess I never related to it very strongly in that regard. That's interesting. I guess the thing that I come away with Nemo, it is more the relationship between Nemo and Dory. That seems to be sort of the real main relationship that forms within the narrative. Like the dad son relationship is kind of almost tangential in comparison.
Right, because they don't spend a lot of time on screen together.
Right.
Yeah, that's a little tricky. Yeah, and honestly, I've always been a little bit confused, distracted is the wrong word, but kind of confused about the nature of the nature of the Dory character. In the sequel, in Finding Dory, you get more out of that. You get a chance for Dory's character to kind of stretch its legs a little bit, but I still don't really get what her purpose within the universe is supposed to be. I guess in the sequel, it becomes more about her mental illness. It becomes a mental illness film, for better or for worse.
Right.
But yeah, honestly, I mean, like you're right. You've classified it correctly. Is that it's about, you know, it's about friendship. It's about, you know, the fathers needing help and friends and that sort of thing and pride, right? But Dory's character is so unusual that and so funny. Unfortunately, that's what you end up focusing on, right. And it might complicate that message a little bit. RoboCop's message is less complicated. It's you know, every bit is deep, but you know, you can tell what it is.
Right. Yeah. I probably saw RoboCop within 2 years of Karate Kid. I would say so, which, you know, probably means that I saw RoboCop way too early, given the amount of extremely graphic violence that's in it. Right. But, you know, it didn't really affect me or impact me in a way that seemed like it. I don't know. It didn't desensitize me, but I didn't feel overwhelmed by the violence in it. It felt that's so over the top and sort of absurdist that I guess I just sort of went with it and just I never really had that problem growing up. I always kind of just understood that it was a movie, and I never really saw it as a reflection of real life. And certainly in RoboCop, it's just so the squib work is just over the top crazy. But like you said, you know, there are moments where, you know, particularly early in the film when he gets basically mowed down, it's incredibly intense and sad, and you feel bad for him immediately. Yeah. And it's almost like a full circle movie where he's trying to search for his humanity from what happened to him, you know, to try to come back to his family and how to just become a regular person again, despite the fact that he's no longer really a human at this point.
Right. And I guess it's always impressed me about RoboCop. And there's a couple other action films of this sort of same genre where it didn't have to do that. It didn't have to be that deep and to be making these really deep societal comments on the nature of corporatization and all that right. stuff. Like they could have made it much more shallow and still made a lot of money. And there's a lot of films that are constructed that way. I mean, one could argue that the reboot of RoboCop is a little lighter on those kind of those deeper spiritual questions. But I'm always impressed whenever a film doesn't have to, and it does. It's like, no, this is the story that we're telling. Like, you know, this giant, we're going to use this pulpy imagery of a robot man enforcing justice as a Trojan horse for us to get this message about our purpose. You know, like, I mean, the key moment for me is when RoboCop, not Murphy, but RoboCop, you know, is talking to the woman that used to be his wife. And mm-hmm. and that line that he gives, they made this to honor him. And you get this sense of the relinquishment of what used to be and this kind of ownership of this new place in society that he now has to hold. I mean, like, it's sort of like this new kind of bizarre kind of adolescence that he's passing through, this cybernetic adolescence. I'm going to go ahead and trademark that domain mm-hmm. name. And I, you know, I'm just really impressed by that. They didn't have to do that, but they did.
I have not seen RoboCop, and so I can't vote here. I do like Finding Nemo a lot. It was one of the Pixar movies that really grew on me. The first time I saw it, I was like, "Eh, that was pretty good." And then my siblings really loved it and watched it at home a lot. And the more that I watched it, the more I was like, "This is really good stuff." So I bet that if I saw RoboCop, I'd probably vote for Finding Nemo. But I have not seen RoboCop, so I don't actually know.
All right. Well, Doug and I are going to go RoboCop over Finding Nemo. All right. Next up, we have The Lion King against Seven. So we have animated Hamlet up against...
No, it's not.
Fincher's serial killer masterpiece. Seven is in my top 20. I think it's one of the best movies ever made. Made me feel amazing coming out of the theater. I knew immediately that it was one of the best things I've ever seen. Yeah, I know it's a very strange thing to say. I'm not sure I
would ever have assumed somebody would say I felt amazing coming out of Seven.
Well, there's something about being exposed to really high quality of anything.
It's true.
I felt electrified. I was so jazzed about seeing it. I was just like, I can't believe how good that movie was. Lion King was a force. It definitely made a huge cultural impact, but it's nowhere near as awesome as Seven is for me. But what do you guys think?
These are probably both in my top 100. I like them both a lot. I have seen Seven less often, not as many times,
yeah,
because it was not in my childhood rotation, which is probably good.
Yeah, it's not something you really want to watch a whole bunch of times necessarily.
No, it's not.
It's a very heavy movie.
But man, it sticks with you.
Sure.
In a lot of ways. And there are a lot of people who I would never, ever recommend that movie to because it does stick with you. And if you're not kind of prepared for that, that can be horrible. But I'm with you, Nate. Like, I think it's... I didn't have quite the same as big a reaction to that, but I remember just being like, that was really, it was just good to watch. It was just fun is not the right word either, because it's not a fun movie, but it's a captivating movie. And like, it just pulls you in, and it's so interesting to see from moment to moment to moment. Lion King, I think, is really great in almost every way. I think it has one of the best Disney villains. I think it has some of the best songs. I think it has some of the, I think it has some really, really lovely, really interesting animation. I think it's one major downfall is its sidekicks. I think Timon and Pumbaa are terrible sidekicks. And they take over in the narrative not as badly as the genie from Aladdin, who I have major issues with, but they take over it, and they take it out of the world that it's been in a way that I don't think serves the story, and make it. I have a really strong problem with pop culture anachronisms in locations where that. Like pop culture references in locations where that makes no sense, and Timon and Pumbaa come very close to that. I don't remember if they ever actually crossed that line. Yes, they do. They sing "The Lion Sleeps Tonight." They are very close to that line at all times and frequently cross over. And it drags the movie down for me in what I think would otherwise be an absolute masterpiece. If they could be edited down to be a much smaller,
you know,
part
what
of the
movie. Though it's like. They're there because if they were not there, think of how dour and downtrodden the whole narrative would become, like how dark it would be.
There's a way to do that, though. Yeah. And I don't think that they did that well, because I don't have a problem with them being in it. I have a problem with what they do when they're there. And so, like, I agree. I think you do need some lightness in the middle there. Otherwise, oh my gosh, it is incredibly depressing because it's Hamlet. I'm sorry, Doug. It is Hamlet, and it's so dark. But it needed to be done in a way where Simba was could be a part of that part of the story and not just kind of tagging along. And even as an adult, he feels very much like he's like tagging along for their ride, as opposed to, yeah, this is my family now. And the anachronisms bug me. and it's something that if they had been written a little bit differently or used a little bit differently, I think the way that they used, for comparison, I think the way they use sidekicks and comedic relief in Beauty and the Beast is brilliant. I think the way that they use Olaf in Frozen is brilliant. It's a perfect use of the sidekick that enhances the story and doesn't detract from it. And so if Lion King had equally perfect sidekicks, it would easily win here. But here, because Seven does not have Timon and Pumbaa and an abundance of fart jokes, it's winning. Even though Seven also doesn't have Be Prepared, which is maybe the best Disney villain song ever.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I'm voting Seven. I'm going to do it.
Now, Hannah, would you get behind a remake of The Lion King?
Yes, it depends.
Let's say same songs. Yeah, let's say same songs, but you can cut any of Timon and Pumbaa songs that you want.
Isn't the musical kind of a remake already?
Well, I mean, I guess
I was going to say, I mean, it's like I thought the new Beauty and the Beast movie was going to be a movie version of the stage show. It's not. but I would totally be behind that. Lion King is one of those that I think could use a little bit of tuning up in terms of just those characters. I think the rest of it is so good. And I think really you could go through like almost line by line and take out individual moments that didn't work. And you could end up with something stronger.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just let them sing Hakuna Matata and then chuck them out the window.
And just about. they gotta help him back on a little bit, but sing Hakuna Matata and then have maybe a little scene afterwards. Cut the weird hula moment. That's nonsense. in a way that makes absolutely no sense for the stakes of their story.
Well, I mean, maybe that kind of stuff is just the reason I'm confused about this label of Hamlet continually being applied to it, because I don't really get the transformation that Simba goes through, right? Like the idea is he's framed. You know, he knows the truth. He runs away from home. And then the lesson that Timon and Pumbaa, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern give him is no worries, right? Like that becomes this fundamental transformative experience for him. He has a little spirit, spirit quest out in the, in the taiga. And then that somehow motivates him to not to run from his past. So no worries.
I don't think that's it. The no worries is not the transformer of the moment. It's the one that allows him to run from everything. It's not until Rafiki shows up that that he makes any kind of confrontation of his past. He just kind of glosses over everything and is like, well, I'm just never going to think about it again. So I don't, that's not the transformer in the moment. That's the one that it's his coping mechanism that lets him survive for a while. And then eventually he's got to deal with it.
Yeah. I guess I get it. Maybe seeing it through an old bitter man's adult eyes would allow me to see, let me to see these character points that I'm supposed to be seeing. I mean, I think that Simba's story that I've always found to be kind of the least interesting of the stories in The Lion King, and that all these marginal interesting characters, they're all in separate movies from each other. And they all seem more interesting, and then we keep cutting away from them, I think that The Lion King is more, for me, it's more important as a musical than as a film. I've never seen a stage musical, and that's, bad on me. I'm going to vote 7 here, because I feel like I get what it's trying to say a little bit better, or at least I'm able to extract and staple together the message, my take home message a little bit clearer from 7. I mean, I've talked on the show about, obviously stylistically and quality wise and writing and acting and everything, all that checks the boxes. But the point of the show is to try to figure out what metric do you use to compare these two? And I think it has to, for me, for these two, it has to be how I'm extracting the message that the movie is trying to tell me. So I'm voting 7 here. It's a little easier for me.
All right. We are unanimous. 7 is beating The Lion King.
Could you help us, Hedwig?
No, I'm not even supposed to be here. I stole a life from Mr. Dennis, but he'll be back real soon. And I can't steal a life for too long, or he'll know and get angry, etc. See ya.
Wait. We heard something. We didn't understand it, but now we do. Do you know what we heard?
What did you hear?
Come here. I'll whisper it to you.
Okay.
All right. It is now time for the title fight. And on this episode, we are going to talk about Split, which is M. Night Shyamalan's latest film and has a sort of a tie to one of his previous films, which I won't spoil, but has a very definitive nod towards one of the older films of Shyamalan's. Split stars James McAvoy as the main central character role of playing many different personalities, hence the name Split. And it also stars a trio of girls, and I can't recall the one main actress's name, but she's quite good in it. It's a really fairly straightforward, I would say, story about some girls that get captured, and you don't, as a viewer, you're not sure why were they captured. Who is this person that captured them? Why are they being held? And then it sort of kind of evolves into figuring out, okay, this person has many personalities. He's got split personalities, and they're all sort of fighting against one another to determine what to do with these girls. And the plot sort of goes from there. It has a fairly broad twist ending within the narrative that's fairly believable, I guess, and works within the context of the story, but it is bordering on the fantasy, I would say. Overall, I felt like it was a pretty solid movie, though. Not quite a Hitchcock or anything like that, but, you know, still fairly interesting, fairly captivating story-wise, and it was a pretty good yarn in terms of how it leaked certain tidbits of information to you as you're watching. So you're kind of you're traveling along with this one main female lead in terms of she's sort of your eyes and ears and brain as you go through the story. And it works pretty well in that regard, I'd say. Where it falls within Shyamalan's filmography, it's certainly not anywhere near as good as Sixth Sense. I would say probably not even as good as Signs or Unbreakable. I haven't seen The Happening. Everybody says it's awful. I also haven't seen The Village, which some people say is terrible because of its ending. And some people say it's just fine. What else am I missing? He did one about
Lady in the Water and The Last Airbender.
Oh, yes. Lady in the Water. I forgot about that one. That one's weird. Not as weird as... Well, I guess it is probably the weirdest one he's done. I don't know. I felt like it was a good movie, but not great. Didn't blow my socks off. So what did you guys think about Split?
I liked Split. I thought it was very interesting. The only Shyamalan movie that I really, really love is Sixth Sense, and that's, I think, in my top 20, so I really love it. Everything else, I think this is probably on par with all his other pretty good ones. I think it's probably, for me, it's probably on par with Signs. It's probably on par with Unbreakable and The Village, which I liked okay. I like The Happening more than anyone is supposed to, but that's a story for another day. And Split is fun because back, like 10 years ago, I became really, really fascinated with multiple personalities with dissociative identity disorder. And I ended up writing a story that plays on some of the facts here, the idea that they can have completely separate lives and that they're there to try to, that they tend to spin off in psychology, as far as we know, to try to be protective of the core self who is, for whatever reason, unable to cope with things or unable to handle things. And so, like, a lot of the stuff that he referenced or brought up were things that I had played with in a novel that I wrote for National Novel Writing Month, like, in 2008.
Nice.
And so I was like, oh, this is like my story. I do think that I liked mine better, but yeah. Only in the sense that I was not a huge fan of the fantasy-esque direction it went at the end. I found that a little silly. Not enough to ruin the movie for me by any means, because right. I think it's a really solid, interesting thriller up until then. I think the way that he feeds the information out to you is really, really well paced, and really it gives you just enough to keep you interested for the next. I think McAvoy is amazing in this. I think this is kind of an incredible performance from him, and these characters would easily be able to just fall into silly caricature, and I think he does a really good job of keeping them as fairly believable full entities in themselves. And I think the, I can't remember the, I cannot remember the main girl's name either, but she's excellent in this as well. I don't think it's a spectacular movie, but I think it's a really solid little thriller, slightly silly ending aside. And I think it's still a fascinating subject, and it's still a subject in psychology that we don't know a lot about. And I'm always happy when stories attempt to tackle it in a slightly more, in a way that makes more sense with what we actually know about the condition. Which is maybe why the fantasy-esque ending bugged me, because I was like, that's not how it works. So maybe it was like, I was so pleased that it hadn't gone, you know, the Fight Club route of tackling that kind of thing, and had really tried to keep to what we know about it, and then threw that away a little bit. But I think it's solid. I think it's fun, and it's gonna win against movies that I think are not as fun, even if they may technically be better.
So the name we're all looking for is Anya Taylor-Joy. Just to give her credit.
Thank you. I was like, it's Anna.
And honestly, I looked it up, but I mean, she does deserve accolades for her performance
here.
She
deserves name recognition.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. On this most famous podcast. Yeah. So, I mean, yes. You know, her performance, it's a very difficult character that has a lot of layers that you don't find out about the layers until later. But you know, it's not hammed up, you know. So I think that she does a really good job with it. For me, I mean, McAvoy's characters, anytime that someone has, like a very unusual character trait, such as say a stutter or, various kinds of mental illnesses or a severe disability, I think that it's really easy for us to say, "Oh, what a great performance!" Because they are able to articulate mm-hmm. that quirk. Quirk's the wrong word. That defining character trait. I find that I'm that puts me at a distance because it's a little bit. The term I use is stunt character, where it's like what you're really evaluating is not their acting job, but how well they're able to embody this thing, right? That's the aspect of the character that's so unusual, that's very difficult for an actor to pull off.
Maybe like Ewan McGregor trying to be Alec Guinness in the prequels. Like you're just constantly aware he's trying to be Alec Guinness.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Forrest Gump is another excellent example.
Sure.
Where like it's difficult for us to figure out exactly how great a performance it is because how well someone plays a disabled man is sort of what we're looking at all the time. And so honestly, each of James McAvoy's characters here, I was not super impressed by any given performance. Maybe Dennis. I think it's Dennis, the main one with OCD.
The main one.
They're all main ones.
The main one was for sure my favorite. The one was I thought was the one that was most impressive.
Because that was the character where he had to kind of pull back, right? Like you had a sense that that character had things that it was protecting and that it was really, you know, struggling internally. A lot of the other characters that struggle wasn't there. And it's less interesting to watch that. But again, you flip from character to character fairly quickly, which is ambitious for a script to do. And so you don't, you know, it's a little bit of a three-card Monty situation where you don't get a chance to kind of notice that unless you're hyper aware of it, like I am, hypercritical of it. I have two more minor points. This is my bottom ranked M. Night Shyamalan movie. My number one is Unbreakable. The Sixth Sense is down number 5 in terms of Shyamalan movies. So I am an Unbreakable man when it comes to Shyamalan. The other point I want to make is, so what that means is that I actually have Lady in the Water ranked above this and The Happening. And I think my second point ties into the reasons for those is because, I'm just going to say it, 10 Cloverfield Lane, right? That came out 9 months previous to Split. We have a situation, we have a really good actress who is kidnapped for no particular reason by a crazy person in the bunker, can't get out. It's about, you know, it's a bottle episode. We're trying to figure out the motivations of the kidnapper. But 10 Cloverfield Lane is a vastly superior film.
It's interesting. I never thought of those two movies.
I'm sure this is a dueling studios situation. You know, like, I'm sure that, like, oh, they, well, what, huh, what script did they just green light? Oh, we got to get one of those. You know, like, I this to me seems super transparent. And that's why I didn't bother to see Split in the theaters. Huh. I saw it recently because I'm a Shyamalan completist, you know, and I think that Split is beautiful, as all of his films are. I was trying to figure out whether he used film cameras or not, and I can't get a straight answer, but it's absolutely beautiful. He has a sense for frame and depth and color, maybe unlike any living director. He uses it to film stories that are very unusual, and I think maybe it's probably causing him to not get the recognition that he deserves for that. I mean, I'm guessing he's going to be remembered in film schools and, you know, cinematography schools going in the future. So that's where I come down on Split.
All right. Well, let's put it up against some other stuff on the chart and see what happens. The first movie it goes up against is Pinocchio, who's got his own sort of Split personality. Being a wooden puppet and a real
Pinocchio
boy.
Pinocchio is a far scarier movie than Split.
Oh, it's not even close.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pinocchio is terrifying. the scene where the child turns into a donkey.
Disney movie ever made.
Scared me for life. I don't know if it's worse than Dumbo's pink elephant scene, but it's up there.
Oh, yeah. It definitely is. The whole Pleasure Island sequence, for sure.
So creepy. So unsettling. And not in a way that I find redeemable at all. So I'm definitely voting Split.
I'm voting Pinocchio on this. I think that it really made me feel things a lot better. It made me feel good as well as bad. It made me feel afraid as well as rejoicing. And the Jiminy Cricket character is very much worthy of his place in the culture. I'm voting Pinocchio here.
I'm thinking mainly just on a technical level that probably Pinocchio is the more impressive movie, just because the animation is so complex in certain parts. It's all the Monstro stuff is really, really cool. But I totally agree that it's terrifying beyond belief. It has no place in any children's watch list by any means. Like, I have purposely not shown it to my kids because I know that it will just wreck them.
It's horrifying.
You know, Lion King too, though, to be fair. Like, I'm hesitant to show my kids Lion King because it gets so dark. And there, a lot of Disney stuff does. Like, Snow White has some pretty dark moments. They go there in a couple movies, and I can't get them away. But I think I'll probably side with Doug, despite feeling terrified of it. I think it's probably the more lasting film, certainly, between these two. And the more technical achievement. So Pinocchio is going to beat Split. Now we've got Split against Spider-Man 3.
I've never seen Spider-Man 3.
Oh. Anna?
I'm voting Split here. I liked portions of Spider-Man 3 a lot, but those portions were small bits of a very long and very messy movie. And
it's rough.
All the stuff with Sandman I thought was amazing. And was like, I want to see him. Just like a whole movie just about him.
The Sandman movie.
Like, I would watch that. but it's, it throws everything at it. And it just gets ridiculous and it gets terrible. And the entire the entire emo Spider-Man, Peter Parker is just like absolutely unwatchably atrocious. Bad, and there's nothing that atrocious in Split.
Have you avoided it, Doug, just because of all of the sort of hearsay of how terrible it is?
I was so disappointed with the first Spider-Man film that I bailed on the franchise, and it's bad on me. Yeah, but
the second one's great.
That's what I hear.
Molina as Dr. Octopus.
Huge Alfred Molina fan.
Fantastic. So. It's well worth seeing.
Noted.
Yeah, the first film's okay. The third film's atrociously bad. Second film's great.
Definitely. How many franchises can you say that about?
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
I will absolutely go Split here because Spider-Man 3 is shit. Now we've got Split against Hitch, an incredibly forgettable Will Smith rom-com.
My one story about Hitch was my mom really liked it, and one day my dad sat down to watch it, and at the end he was like, "Huh, that Jennifer Lopez didn't look very much like herself in that movie." And we're like, "What are you talking about? That wasn't Jennifer Lopez's name." Like, "Oh, that's why."
That would explain it.
So Hitch is that forgettable that even the main actors are not memorable for who they are. Hitch is completely. I wouldn't fight for anything. Split's going to win for me.
I don't remember anything about what happens in Hitch. I know Will Smith is in it. That's all I know.
Well, for me, Kevin James for me is what Hitch is about. I mean, I'm a huge Kevin James fan. I think he's underappreciated because he chooses terrible projects. but he has a scene towards the beginning when Hitch is kind of like evaluating him for his case or whatever, where he has a very simple scene where he's eating lunch on the steps of a government building, and there's no dialogue, and he's just confused about where to set down his hot dog and where to pick up the soda, but the napkin flies away, and it reminded me of Buster Keaton. Like, it was that that level of like genius with props and like befuddlement and a stone face. It's not enough to redeem Hitch, but I think that it's worth seeing it if you like comedy, you should see Kevin James's performance in Hitch, and then
skip all the Will Smith stuff.
Yeah, just drink during those scenes, and it'll be fine. I'm voting Split here.
That's great. I don't even remember him being in the movie.
That's a bad sign.
that is not good.
All right, so Split's now going up against Tomorrow Never Dies.
I don't remember if I've seen Tomorrow Never Dies.
Jonathan Pryce is all you have to remember about Tomorrow Never Dies.
Oh, well, then I definitely didn't. I would remember Jonathan Pryce. He's a musical theater guy.
Yeah.
So I would have remembered if I saw him in it.
Great film.
Like, I know everything he's in.
Good role in Game of Thrones, too.
Yes, he is. So I can't vote.
So you're abstaining.
Yeah, I think I'll go Split. I think it's more interesting. All right, so Global say Split's at 23.55 and Tomorrow Never Dies is at 38.75. So Split will take it or Tomorrow Never Dies. Ooh, Split against When Harry Met Sally. I'll have what she's having.
I love When Harry Met Sally. I think it's beautifully written and really nicely acted, and it is absolutely beating Split for me here, which is fun but messy and strange.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Harry Met Sally fan. I am a huge Billy Crystal fan, so I'll just sort of, I enjoy anything he's in. I don't think necessarily this is his best work, but I think it's a very charming film, and it'll win here for me.
Yep, I would agree with all of that. It's a pretty good script and fun characters, and it's believable. The ups and downs of romance over the years. So When Harry Met Sally wins. Now we got Split against The Santa Claus.
Oh boy.
I do not have fond feelings about The Santa Claus. I think it's fine. This is a case of me hating the movie because I saw the two sequels and they're so bad that they make me attach horrible things to the first one, that it was actually probably a fine movie.
They went into the past and sucked the joy out of a previous film.
They did. And now I see the Santa Claus and I'm just like, oh, gross. And then I'm like, well, maybe I'm not being fair. But if you average the three of them out.
if the first one was that good, then you would remember it independently of the other ones.
Exactly. Right? And it was, I remember thinking that it was okay. It's not like, it's what it is. And it doesn't really attempt to be anything more than that. And I don't like Tim Allen that much. So that shtick doesn't work for me.
It's not like Psycho to Psycho 2. Or no. Jaws to Jaws 2.
No.
Santa Claus 2 is not that long of a drop.
It's not a huge step down.
Right.
It didn't have that far to fall.
So which one are you picking?
Oh, I'm choosing Split. I like Split.
I'm probably going to choose Split just on just visual artistry. That's going to be my metric here. It's more beautiful. I probably feel the same way about both of these films. But Split is gorgeous, so I'm picking it.
Yep. All right, Split's gonna beat Santa Claus. Now we have Split against Passengers.
I did not see Passengers.
Nor I.
All right. Oh, okay. That's up to me, I guess.
It's all you.
Well, I talked on a previous episode about Passengers and mainly that it's a good movie with a script that's written incorrectly, essentially. Like it's a good movie that is just not put together in the correct way.
Right. You said that you kind of lost sympathy for the characters halfway through or something, right?
Right. You get to a point and you're just like, I want to be out of this movie.
Yeah,
I don't want
to
be here anymore.
No, I watched, and maybe it's the same one that you've looked at. I watched a video talking about how it's just told wrong. It's told backwards.
Yeah.
And how the beginning of the movie should be seen halfway through as a flashback. And knowing what I knew of the movie, I watched that video and I was like, oh,
interesting.
Okay. I might like, cause I avoided it knowing the premise and knowing that it was probably something that was going to make me angry. If it had been told that way, that would have made more sense and that would have not made me angry. And I probably would have been like, yes, I'm going to see it because I love Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you totally spoiled the movie for yourself then.
I did. I knew it was happening because there was the whole outrage and I was like, why should I not see this? And then I was like, oh, it'll probably make me really mad.
Yeah, it does. It does make you angry. And, you know, there's one school of thought that says to make it a romance.
And it's like,
yeah, right. There's one school of thought that says, okay, if it makes you feel something, then it's doing something right. You know, even if that emotion is anger. But yeah, it's just not, it's not what you expect. And the way that it's unexpected is disappointing and anger inducing at the same time. So it
makes
from
what I gathered, it didn't seem like that was what they intended. Like they hadn't intended it for it to make people angry.
Yeah.
Like that they were still thinking that this was just like a charming romance.
Yeah.
Romance adventure. And so that's not a deliberate intentional decision. That's a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Whereas Split doesn't really have any kind of glaring script mistakes, so to speak. It's pretty well crafted. Even if it gets sort of sci-fi fantasy-ish,
but that was intentional.
Within the
it wasn't
context
like they accidentally made
on.
That happen.
Right. Right. So it's all foreshadowed correctly as it's supposed to.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's give it to Split then over Passengers. Now we've got Split against The Abyss. No way, Split. No way.
These are probably pretty evenly matched for me. I didn't like The Abyss as much as I wanted to. And I liked Split about as much as I thought I was going to. Or as much as I hoped I was going to. And so they both probably end up in like the 75%, maybe 70% mark on my chart. You're both voting Abyss though, right?
Yes, yeah. Ma'am.
Then I'll vote for Split. Just to, if I can't choose, it doesn't, my vote doesn't matter anyway. So I'll vote for Split.
The Abyss is my number 9 of all time, folks. I love.
I did not like it that Abyss. Much, but I thought it was interesting.
It's probably the most technically incredible movie ever.
That's one for me. That I would really love to see on a big screen.
Oh, yeah.
Like absolutely. that would be a whole different, like that might drastically change my opinion of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Abyss is going to beat Split. And now we've got Split at 254 on our chart. That's out of 472 movies.
Halfway-ish. So,
yeah. It's all right. What are you going to say? Decent Shyamalan flick. All right. Well, that's a wrap for this episode of Flick Fights. But you can continue to follow our chart's progress. Just find us as Flick Fights on Flickchart, and you can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. And if you want to be a future guest, join us on these crazy fights that we have. Send us an email to flickfights@flickchart.com. And from all of us at Flick Fights, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.